It's Wednesday night, and we're in the beginning of a session, which we started this morning, a retreat to gather the mind. Some of us have been sitting since this morning, and this morning I spoke about the three aspects of retreat: the outer retreat of setting up the schedule and the forms and the boundaries of practice that help support settling into the simplicity of the moment, and the inner retreat of settling into the simplicity of the moment, and the innermost retreat of our true nature, settle on our true nature. That one, that innermost retreat has been going on since beginningless time and will never end. And it's also supporting our outer and inner retreat. And the outer and inner retreat help us to open to the innermost retreat. And I asked this morning some people who are on this retreat, why would they come to a retreat? Why come and put everything aside and make this effort to do this? And quite a few people said to support others practice. I was quite impressed. That's a beautiful reason to do anything, you know? So, you could say sounds like we have kind of like a bodhisattva retreat going on, where people are coming to the retreat to support others in the retreat. And especially, I think we think of supporting others through the outer retreat, which is like, we help maintain the forms, we keep the chanting going, we try to stay silent, we keep sitting, following the schedule to support the others, is all the outer retreat. And it may be, we didn't get into the details, but I thought afterwards, I wonder if the way that we support others on the retreat is mostly the outer retreat. Is that how we... that's the obvious way to support others. But I don't know, maybe people also feel that the inner retreat of really not following out our thought streams, returning to the present, is also helping others. Maybe harder to see how that's so. Well, I think there was some expression about, well, when we're calm and clear, then we can meet others more fully. But I was contemplating this after that discussion and thought, can we see the inner retreat, which is quite private, right? People don't really know what's going on in our minds. But can we diligently let go again and again of these thinking patterns to deepen our own practice as an offering to others? And I thought, this is kind of like bodhicitta. Classic bodhicitta is the vow to, could even say, personally realize the great awakening of a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. And I think that's the work of the inner retreat, as well as the outer. But that's something to consider. Do we? We're taking very good care of the outer retreat for others. Can we do that? We might feel like, well, that's enough. The inner thing is really my own. I don't care so much about my own, necessarily. I might not care so much about my own crazy mind. But if I sit still, I'm supporting the others. And that's the main thing. This is a wonderful intention, but can we shift it if we're not already to, may I tame this mind for the benefit of all beings. In my early years of practice, I recall my teacher said something like, it was a long time ago, but he said something like, a Buddha is one whose mind is completely out of control. And they're no longer trying to control their mind. That's what a Buddha is. And something ran true about that to me. It was kind of a radical statement, I thought, at the time. Because I was, always trying to do something about my mind, control it in some way. He said, a Buddha is one who sees that their mind is totally out of control and doesn't try to control it. And the first time that I went to India, maybe not so long after I heard my teacher say that, this was maybe 23 years ago, I was checking out various practice places, and I was in Dharamsala, where there's a large Tibetan refugee community where the Dalai Lama lives, and there was a retreat center called Tushita Heaven. Has anybody been? So somehow I ended up there, and there was an Indian monk ordained by the Dalai Lama who spoke fluent English and was giving these teachings to Westerners. And he was telling his own story, how he was actually born a Sikh. I think part of the Sikh religion is that they have this like metal bracelet, and maybe at a young age, like the initiation into the Sikh religion. So I don't know the details, but they have for life, they have this bracelet that as they grow, they can't take it off anymore because it's too small. And there's something also like a lock of hair or something that always grows. Something about never cutting a part of their hair are some of the signs of that, one of the many Indian religions. And he was a Sikh, but he, it's actually just coincidence that I bought this book for another purpose, but this is the book called Meditation on Emptiness. He was reading in English as like a teenager, and he was like obsessed with this. And over again, this big book he would read until he was like, this is like, there's nothing else to do in this life but this practice. And so he went and became a monk. And to do that, he had to remove his Sikh bracelet and cut that lock of hair, and so he went to like a welder or something to have it like cut off this bracelet and then and have his hair cut. And apparently they gave him a hard time because they're like, well, you must be a criminal trying to change your identity, because no Sikhs ever cut their bracelets off or their hair. So he was kind of like struck by the Buddha's teaching, and that's what I'm going to do. And his name is Dharmakirti. And it's funny how the world works, because then, like, quite some years later, 10 years later, maybe something, I moved to this place, No Abode Hermitage, and was practicing there with this another priest named Chusan. And she was she had lived in Dharamsala for a while, years back, practicing with that community there. And and one time I was telling her, I think, about, oh yeah, I met this guy who was a Sikh and had to cut off her bracelet. Really? And it turned out that after I had met him briefly at that one talk, he had later decided to follow like the lay yogi path, lay tantric yogi path, and returned to lay life and grew out his hair and long dreadlocks and continued to study meditation on emptiness, and got together with this woman, Chusan. And they were like, they lived together as partners in India for some years. Thought, what a strange world. And now I was like living in this Zen hermitage, practicing with her on the other side of the world. So all that's just done to mention this fellow Dharmakirti, who was a monk at that time. I remember he was giving this talk where he said, a Buddha is someone who has complete control over their mind. I think I raised my hand and said, my teacher in America says a Buddha is one who has no control over their mind and has given up trying to control it. And he said, well, then he's wrong. I think I tried to defend him for a little while. Got a little worked up. And and as it occurs to me now, that it may be that both answers are true. I think letting the mind be out of control and not trying to control it, I think it's a kind of a Zen instruction from a very sort of ultimate point of view, almost like the final fruition. Well, he was talking about Buddha, actually. that the way I would see it now is a Buddha has gone through long, long training and practice of, maybe we don't want to use the word control, but like taming their mind for a long, long time, really like with some effort and intention and diligence, really like not letting the mind run wild. Right up to the very point where, in the end, they understand how it all works, and then the mind is actually not running that wild, but they're also not trying to control it. So, in this sesshin, I'd like to bring up various Zen teachings. And maybe we get into the ultimate uncontrolled mind by the end of Sesshin, but I just really want to emphasize how I'm feeling these days like we really need this kind of diligent practice. If we skip the stages of really working with the mind and taming our habitual mind tendencies, if we skip that, then I think we may be fooling ourselves. Say, oh, this is just the Buddha, I'm letting the mind go wild. I think more and more that there's a lot of work to be done beforehand. Mm. Maybe along the way, we also see how the mind is ultimately uncontrollable and there's no one to control it, but still we're doing this work. It's the hard work of Sesshin. And sometimes we don't, I think part of the Zen style is sometimes we don't talk about the basics that much. Maybe we do. Patrick just did a class on meditation here. I think he got into four foundations of mindfulness and some things like that that maybe wouldn't be traditionally taught in Zen. So, we want to be free of the bondage of our karmic patterns in order to be of best possible benefit to everyone. So we want to, as part of the story is that we, if there's some sense of separation between self and other, this duality is taught to be like the source of all our conflicts and problems. So the more we can realize that really there is no separation of mind and objects, then this is how we can be of the ultimate benefit to others. And in order to realize this, there's various paths. So this year so far we've been talking about loving kindness and compassion. So this is one path. I think all of these can be combined too in different permutations, but sometimes it's even taught that if you take that practice to its fullest, like complete unbiased and unconditional love and compassion for all beings. And we could even say relative bodhicitta, generating this intense wish to free everyone from suffering, that actually culminates in ultimate bodhicitta of selflessness. So love and compassion in a relative mind training kind of way could be just that practice alone. Could be that if one took it to its complete fruition, that would be the realization of non-duality of self and other. It kind of moves in that direction from the start, but that could be a complete path of practice. Another path of practice to realization of non-duality could be total devotion. Like to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Feeling this heart sense of devotion to the Buddhas and ancestors and teachers and bodhisattvas and everyone who helps us along the way, that almost like surrender kind of devotion, again, to its full completion, could end up in the realization of non-duality of self and other. Again, from the start, that's the way it's headed. So that could be a whole path. Another path could be logic and reasoning and investigation. This would be like the path of Madhyamaka, reasoning, using reasoning and logic to dismantle our illogical mind that's our everyday mind, it's proposed, is based on actually faulty logic. So through very clear and precise and diligent investigation of how things really are, our usual thinking can fall apart and we can realize non-duality. Again, if we took it to the final end, otherwise it's just a bunch of strenuous study that gives us a headache. And another path would be like all these Zen koans show us, right? Like meeting in a state of great openness and receptivity, meeting a teacher who turns us, gives a turning word, and releases us from where we're stuck. That's of these four, that's maybe the most classical Zen method. But Zen includes all of these. Zen includes kindness and compassion, devotional practice, some reasoning and logic, and in fact, you could almost say koans have their own kind of logic in a way. And it's direct pointing. And all of these could be combined with meditative settling. So we need some methods, some mind training to realize the untamable mind of non-duality. So I hope to keep continuing looking at kindness and compassion practices this year, to work on that side of things. I hope to keep having devotional practices of making offerings like Buddha's birthday, where you can get totally into it. If you want, while you're bathing baby Buddha, you can imagine that this is actually Shakyamuni Buddha, and your water tea offering there is like the most heartfelt gift you've ever made. And we can keep exploring the logic of reality. And since we're in Sesshin, let's really look at the meditation that can create the strong foundation for a direct pointing, where we can really let go in a moment. So a little bit of just Zazen instruction. Yeah. I've been finding it helpful to look at these three aspects of meditation. And I'm not talking about the non-dual realization of non-duality. Letting the mind be totally out of control. This is like setting up the foundation to let the mind be out of control. This is the kind of, a little bit like controlling, or at least training and taming the wild mind. So the first of these three aspects is relaxation. Really deeply relax. I think maybe Zen Zen meditation manuals don't emphasize this part so much, because Zen has this intensity we were talking about this morning. But I think it's in there, and I think it's really important even to say, first of all, relax the body. We can stay upright, but let everything totally settle. The body, the breath, relax, and the mind, relax. And they all three support each other, body, breath, and mind. When one relaxes, the other two do. And these are, again, some things that I've been finding helpful is in breathing, to let the breath flow really freely. And when breathing in, to let it settle down into the lower belly and let it fill down there. And imagining that the breath is actually going all the way down to the base of the spine. And I find when doing this practice, you can check it out for yourself right now as you do this, that there's a certain place where it's feeling the lower belly, and then there's like this other step that for me is not a natural thing, to let the breath flow in even more than the lower belly, down to the base of the spine. These last few inches of breath, of course the lungs aren't really down there, but it's an energetic thing, and it's quite tangible in my experience, that there's a little bit of holding in our lower body there. And to completely relax the few inches between the dantian, which is a few inches below the navel, below the belly button, and down to the base of the spine, internally in the center of the body there, to relax those last few inches, it's a whole different energetic feeling. Can you sense that? And that's like, it's just like, it's like several layers deeper in relaxation. It's like if the rest of the body can be really relaxed, but there's this little bit of tension down there. And when the breath energy, what we're actually talking about here is like chi, or like, you know, wind or subtle energy, prana. I think that's what's actually feeling down there. So it's very relaxing and very enlivening. Breathing down the front of the body, all the way down to the base of the spine. Holding it for a moment without controlling the breath. Let the breath then naturally rise up the spine. The energy. But it's a kind of like imagining this, because mind completely affects internal energy. So all the way up to the top of the head, filling the whole body down the front and up the back. So these are some, you know, Chinese ways of breathing that I just find very settling for Zazen, especially these last few inches down to the base of the spine when breathing in. Really relaxing. And if the body in Sesshin, for those sitting these long 5 days, if it becomes uncomfortable, it will become uncomfortable. And therefore, maybe it goes against classic Zen tradition, but I'm a proponent of let's be comfortable. Let's, especially our legs, let's arrange our legs. I don't think it matters that much what we do with the legs. I think the upper body being upright is most important aspect of the posture. And cross-legged is good, works well for me, but because it's quite comfortable. So if it's not, then find a comfortable way to arrange the legs. And the hands around this lower abdomen. They help draw the energy in here. The breath comes down to right where the hands are circling, and then we draw it down further. But the hands there have an energetic effect. I don't think it's just a random aesthetic thing. But that was subtle stuff. And if it's not comfortable, which it's not for some people, this is also good on the hands on the knees. Maybe help support the posture more. Again, maybe because I'm so used to it, I find this very helpful. But sometimes sitting on my own, this has almost a little bit more kind of like just a slightly different feeling of kind of openness. And this is a more like drawing the energy in. It's subtle, but I think all of these things are things to experiment with in sesshin, especially for those who are sitting the 40, 50 periods left that we have. We have a lot of time for experimenting. It's a great, I've mentioned this before, I often see sesshin as like a laboratory. You can really, like, you have some time to really check out your mind, body, subtle body, and try different things. Don't just be like, well, this is the way, it's worked in the past, let's do it. So if you find something that works, then that's great. And so, but I'll offer some things you might try if you haven't before. I'm often trying new things. And as I said this morning, I confessed that in some years at Tassajara, when living down there, doing practice periods where we'd be sitting all day, I feel like there were years that I almost feel like I wasted on the cushion. Not completely wasted, but there was like, I'm just like, well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to sit here. And I didn't explore too many different possibilities. Some. And I think also I was maybe... After that Indian monk said, Buddha is in total control of your mind, I'm like, well, I'm not so into that. So I kind of just like, well, let it go. And retrospectively looking back, I think that accounted for a lot of waste of time, to be honest. Maybe not. Somebody else might look into my mind and say, that was the best. What are you talking about? But this is how I feel. Is that like just in the last few years, my zazen is quite different, and it has to do with some of like really having a strong intention to be here. Yes, Richard.
Well, I want to see if your idea of experimentation includes sitting with a koan, sitting with an affirmation. For example, I am full of loving kindness. Instead of just, is that something you would say? Well, we could play with that.
Of course.
Does it mean not just being quiet?
You can, not out loud, right? But yeah. I mean, that's what I think. It's really like each of us has different inclinations, and there's no rules about what you're doing in zazen. So that's part of the beauty. There's some traditions where it's like guided throughout, and this is what you do, and they ask you to just do that. And so yeah, you can try different things, and I would probably not bring up every practice in the Dharma realm, the sesshin. So I might not bring those ones up. I'm often bringing up the stuff that I'm working on myself because it's most alive. But so if I do bring up something and something's really alive for you, then you can forget about it after the talk. But some of the practices I'm intending to bring up. I was thinking like a theme for this sesshin. I thought about at the last sesshin, we were talking a little bit about this practice of turning the light around, shining back. And at the time in that sesshin, I thought, this deserves a whole sesshin. So that was kind of my intention, but even though I haven't brought it up yet, this session, because I thought maybe after a few days of this, these like really, really grounding, somewhat easier practices, actually, I would say, of like, again, these three parts, before I lose it. Relaxation, so important. If we find in meditation our body, mind, and energy are getting tight or restless, relax. Breathe deeply, relax the body, relax the mind into the present. Usually non-relaxation is connected with not being present. Mind relaxation and body, even body relaxation. Again, this is like a proposal you could check out for yourself. If your body, mind, and subtle energy do not seem relaxed but seem tight, see if there's some kind of like obsessive thought patterns about the past or future. Maybe not always the case, but I think often. So relaxation, and then based on relaxation, as I mentioned this morning, mindfulness or attention to a specific object. And I think this is where I feel like when I talk about my wasted years, I think this was part of the thing. It's like I heard about this objectless meditation and well, let's just sit without an object. Just sit here and see what happens and just be here. And, you know, if you sit long enough, you do get kind of settled. But again, in my present experience, I feel like I think I was often fooling myself. It wasn't really objectless. It was just kind of like daydreaming. Maybe subtle daydreaming. So that's why we'll get into objectless. I think the turning the light around practice culminates in objectlessness, but to jump right into that, my feeling is that actually very rarely works. And I think this is, if you take Zen just straight out of the classic texts, sometimes it's presented that way, just go right to complete emptiness and non-duality. Well, I don't know if it's that realistic. Maybe for some people. So that's why I think to start with, I'm in Sesshin, this is where I've been all day. I'm trying to work with diligently attending to a chosen object. And we can come up with our own. But I'm feeling in my own practice that to be really clear that there is an object and what it is, and like the intention is to like keep the attention on this object, which I think classic one is the breath, is a wonderful object. So the mind is attending to the sensation of the breath. It's somewhat dualistic because there's a mind and an object. I think it's good. Get really grounded in this, and then another object. So the breath, especially that whole cycle of breath, really attending to it, counting the breath in sets of 10, or however you want. Again, some of my experiments today were like, I was really trying to count to make sure I was on track, and some points when it wasn't even necessarily that concentrated, but was just getting tired of counting, and actually feeling like the counting was not, like especially this last few inches of breath here, when I was counting, I was having trouble completely relaxing down at the bottom, base of the spine. And then I stopped counting and just followed the cycle of the breath. And immediately, like, the mind just settled and became more present and more relaxed. So these are like, that was like a surprising result of an experiment for me. I was like, I shouldn't probably let go of the breath yet because I'm not, like, not, there's still thoughts coming in here and pulling me away, but let's let go. And I felt like, just because, I think the reason it worked was because it was a little bit more relaxed. I think sometimes our distraction is not because we need to concentrate harder, it's because we actually need to relax more. It's kind of counterintuitive, but these are some of my experiments. So, relaxation, mindfulness or attention on an object. And you could change in the middle of a period. Sometimes I've thought, maybe you shouldn't change. I think it's okay as long as it's very conscious. Now I feel like I've been following the breath and I want to open it up. It feels, even that feels too narrow. I want to widen this because I feel really present and open. Now I can open the object, for example, to the whole present experience, which I would still propose is a meditation object. The mind is now attending to the whole experience of the present moment with all the senses open, but particularly the quality of presence or now, the now quality. And so that's another object. Because it's a little wider, it's a little easier to lose it than the breath. But Sashin, maybe we can stay with it. And then third quality, besides relaxation and present awareness, is attentiveness, mindfulness. Third quality helps us stay with it, and that's vigilance or alertness. Almost like there's a monitor. This is just a way of talking about there's one mind here, but this mind has different aspects. One aspect is checking. In fact, the monitor here is kind of checking on all three of these. Checking on himself. I'm vigilance. How am I doing? I was actually just taking a coffee break. I lost a bunch of stuff in the last 5 minutes, so excuse me, I'm back now. The vigilance checking on itself. Also, vigilance is checking on the relaxation. Forgot all about that. I'm being so vigilant here, I'm getting kind of like tight. Can I relax? Vigilance. It's not demanding these other qualities to do what it says. It's just checking. It's just a monitor. Okay, relax. And then mainly, I think what vigilance is doing is it's like checking on the object of meditation. It's like, what was it? Oh, the breath. I forgot all about it, actually. Oh yeah, come back. And we come back. So if the vigilance is strong, it's really watching carefully, very attentive. It's very alert, attentive, like, but not uptight. Right? So this is the experiential key: is vigilance and total relaxation, which really do work together. Maybe you know this in your own experience. They can work together very harmoniously. And the vigilance is checking, is the mind like forgot the object? Just stay with it. It's kind of relaxed sitting there, but it's watching. So the mindfulness is like, whoops. And the vigilance is just like an alertness. And when we notice, we just come back. So no self-judgment, no criticizing ourselves for how the period's going. Maybe sometimes we're really distracted. And the key there is to not get upset about it. Well, that's the nice thing about Sashin. Still have 45 more periods. That one's done. Kind of missed some opportunities there. We got a lot more. Let's renew enthusiasm. So I think really key, and I don't know, where different people are at. Maybe you're feel like, wow, I'm not that attentive. I'm often not that attentive, but in Sashin, I'm really trying to stay with it. So these three: relaxation, attentive mindfulness, and vigilance, all three working together as a team to create a very still, open presence. This is not the whole story of Zazen, but it's creating a really wonderfully pleasant and buoyant and awake foundation. I've been enjoying today, making this effort. It's some effort. And since I don't know where people are at, maybe tomorrow we can see where you're at. But it may be that, because I know sometimes in Sishin I can be this way, like, well, I'm not, forget it, you know. I'm like, all this stuff was happening in my life just before Sishin, and like, my mind is like all over the place, and there's all these things I'm trying to work out. And that sounds very idealistic, what you're saying, Kokyo. I think sometimes if I had heard this kind of thing, I would have said that in my mind. I don't know about that. It sounds too idealistic. But then I would say, if we're really, if the mind's really like, I'm just totally, I have obsessions going here, and, you know, forget this kind of refinement, then I would say, you can still keep working on those, but in some sense, I would say maybe it's okay to forget about it. Forget about these three temporarily, maybe, if your really mind is really going. And give yourself a Dharma talk. I do this. It works often. And, you know, I think the Dharma talk I like to give in that situation, like a pep talk, right? If I catch, like, well, okay, like, this is like, I'm, you know, this morning I talked about retreat. You could think of, like, as an army when the battle's getting too intense, the battle of life is getting too intense, the army retreats to kind of gather its energy. So Sishin is kind of like that. The battle of our life, maybe, it's often very intense. So Sishin's a nice time to like retreat from that. But if we take it into Sishin with us, that battle in our mind, oh, I gotta work that out with that, and like, oh, I feel so bad. Like, then I think that's when this talk, this Dharma talk to myself, is like, first of all, as other people mentioned this morning, remember. It's remembering some things that we already know. Remember that this is this amazing, rare opportunity to sit Sishin. We feel like, well, I don't know how I got into it, and I don't feel like that now. I feel like it's just a burden. And how did I end up here again? I vowed to never come back to a Sishin, and I forgot about it until I got back in it, and I remembered how horrible it is. How painful and it's distressing. And but to turn that, remember, like, oh no, actually this is the Buddha offered this kind of retreat practice as like the greatest gift. It's like really an opportunity to discover anew, clarify and actualize our deepest intention. A time to really let go of that battle, so we can go back to the battle, like, totally refreshed. So, I think just appreciation, actually. Remembering that it really is a special gift, and we can remember times before when we know that it's a special gift. We just don't feel like it right now. So remember, the gift of Sishin and the gift of human life is a rare opportunity. And then another remembrance that goes with this in this Dharma talk to myself is remember that it's impermanent. In fact, the whole day of Sishin's already gone. We don't even have four whole days left. It's quickly passing, and it's going to be a while to the next one. And it's a precious gift, so I don't want to waste it. And like, really, like, put aside all those, you know, this is like just conceptual thinking. But I think it's helpful if our mind's really not into it. Kind of like, it's in a way part of this logical reasoning type of thinking mind. It's, you know, if these things ring true, for me they ring true. Oh, it is impermanent. Both the sesshin is a precious gift and the sesshin is impermanent. Human life is a precious gift. Human life is impermanent. I try to remember regularly, and as I'm approaching 50 years old, it freaks me out. I don't know how people older than me deal with this fact. No choice.
Just give up.
Yeah, we just give up. It's, and we don't know how long we have, and but it's passing. And I can think of from when I was a little kid. In a way, it doesn't seem that long ago. So for the time from then to now is the same time from now to the end. Actually, it's probably less time to the end. And then it's like gone. Oh, we don't know what happens next. Maybe we get another opportunity based on how we've done in this one. Or maybe there's no more nothing. But in either case, this is it. This is our opportunity now. And all those things that the battle that we're obsessed about, that we've temporarily retreated from, you know, on our deathbed, it's not going to matter. None of that stuff matters. Even our health, even our serious health, at that point is not going to matter. If we're very unhealthy on our deathbed, we probably will be. Actually, it won't matter anymore. Okay, it does matter some now, right? But the things that we're obsessed about, our financial status will certainly not matter. Even our friends and family, nothing's going to come with us at the end. Except, according to some stories, the only thing that does come with us is the result of our practice in this life. None of the material world comes along. But, you know, whether we believe that or not, it's a precious opportunity and it's quickly passing. I think that in itself isn't, you know, there's more. We could give ourselves a long Dharma talk. Sometimes I do it for a whole period. I get carried away. depends. And then sometimes we don't need it. Or we get, I think this is like, you know, we vow to renounce worldly affairs for the time of sesshin. It's hard. It's changing. It's going into this completely different zone. I kind of dread it a little bit. Like a few days before sesshin, I always start to feel it. I'm a little bit anxious because I'm like, actually, I'm going to leave this world in some ways for a week. And there's some anxiety about that. Like existential anxiety, I think. Not like practical things. The practical things are all taken care of in my life. I try to arrange it. I turn on the email vacation setting and all that, you know. Everything, there's nothing I have to do this week, actually. But there's still this feeling of all that stuff that's like the dominant things in my life. It's just not going to be part of my life this week. That's right. And then it's quite wonderful to really release it temporarily. So, there's some thoughts about sesshin. Any comments or questions, especially about, for those who are going to keep sitting for a while, about these three aspects of settling the mind? Yes.
Question regarding the past that you spoke of earlier.
The past?
The path.
The path.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Do we choose the path, or does the path choose us through Zazen?
Hmm. You mean about, like, particularly what practice we're going to do on any given day or period?
No.
The bigger path.
Bigger.
The bigger path. I think some of each, actually, right? It's kind of given to us, and yet our own, you know, inclinations and intentions create it too. Like Dogen says, life, the path of life, is like riding in a boat. And so you raise the sails, and so then the wind is carrying you, but also you're at the helm also. So it's the wind of the world, all the elements, dependent co-arising, is carrying our boat of the path of life. And at the same time, we can steer this way or that. You might say, well, who is that one steering? So on a deeper level, on the deepest level, it's like, well, there's nobody really there except a bunch of conditions. So on the deepest level, it's like there's no self to decide. It's all conditioned. But practically speaking, as a kind of like instruction, Dogen says, steer. And that's why I offer these 3 points. It's kind of like, steer. don't just like let yourself be carried by the wind, which is often the wind of karma. Right? So steer is like the intention, arousing the intention to relax, to attend to the moment, and to be vigilant. And then the larger path, same, yeah. Like Zen path versus Sufi path, or some combination of all these, spiritual path, is I think very mysterious how that works.
And one more question. When we, during Zazen, when the object, when we expand on the object, that sounds like shikantaza almost. It sounds sort of like...
Yeah, when you expand the object from the breath to the wider field of experience, some people might call that shikantaza. In the past, I called that shikantaza. But as I say, I'm constantly changing. So these days, I feel like shikantaza is more subtle than that. But it's based on that. And we'll talk about this more, the sesshin, but, you know, for those who aren't going to be here later days, the basic difference in subtlety is duality. That this is, you know, the mind attending to our experience is still, there's a mind and an object. It's just the object's big and not a pinpointed object. But it could be that in that very practice, the sense of duality of mind and object, especially if the vigilance is really strong, it could be that that sense of duality naturally dissolves. Or there's various practices that we can like fine-tune it to drop away the whatever subtle sense of duality is there, like turning the light around. So, but yeah, I think a good point, because I think a lot of people would say that shikantaza, and I'm not saying that my version of shikantaza is correct. I'm saying it's my current understanding of what Dogen is talking about in the zazen that Dogen speaks of, is the culmination of the practice and realization of totally culminated enlightenment. So that's like that's a mouthful. So if we have, that's a kind of high standard. So then I don't want to I don't want to water down. If we're saying shikantaza is that, then I don't want to sell myself short, or you. So let's go back and do something. Something. However you like to creatively explore this mind in the few days we have left of this life before the big wave comes. We dedicate any merit arising here to all living beings everywhere. May they find relaxation and vigilance. Beings are numberless. I